Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. When I was a kid, like so many other children in the 60s, I loved Flipper. Yes, the pet dolphin adopted by game warden Porter Ricks and his two sons, Sandy and Bud. I can't believe I remember that, but what fascinated me was how the bottlenosed dolphin used sound to locate things underwater. About the same time, I discovered Roger Payne's recordings of the songs of humpback whales. And my favorite Star Trek movie is Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, which features two humpbacked whales named George and Gracie at a place that looks suspiciously like the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Spoiler alert, it was. So when I visited the scientific sister of the aquarium, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, also known as MBARI, at Moss Landing, I was fascinated to hear about the acoustics research being conducted there. And thanks to Kim Fulton Bennett, MBARI's public information specialist, I was able to set up interviews with two amazing scientists who use sound to study the ocean, Kelly Benoit Bird and John Ryan. Later on in the program, we'll hear from Ryan about his use of hydrophones to record amazing sounds from the Monterey Bay area, and we'll hear many of those sounds throughout the show. But first, let's hear our conversation with senior scientist and MacArthur fellow Kelly Benoit Bird about how she, kind of like Flipper and his kin, uses sonar to learn about the behavior of marine animals to help us better understand how they find food in the vasty deep. Kelly joined us from MBARI in Moss Landing.
Thank you. It's nice to be here today.
I'm really curious about you before we get into some of your research. Because so many young people, children, you know, they go to an aquarium or something and they think, oh, I'd like to become an oceanographer or an ocean scientist. And very rarely does that actually happen. So in your case, it did. I'd like to know, you know, when did that spark first come for you where you first got interested in becoming a scientist studying the ocean?
Well, I think you might have read a few of my bios because I decided I wanted to be a marine scientist when I first got to go to an aquarium in elementary school. So you just told my story.
Well, I missed the aquarium part, but I think I saw somewhere that you were, you know, interested in it in school. What was it about the aquarium visit that got you interested? And when did the interest in sound come along?
Well, those two things kind of came together. The first time I went to an aquarium, I learned a lot about how marine mammals, dolphins specifically, use sonar, use echolocation to be able to sense their environment. And I was really intrigued that they could use a sense that was so different from what we're familiar with when we use vision for most tasks. And the idea that they could see underwater with sound really fascinated me. And that's still a central part of my research today.
You know, it's interesting that triggered a memory for me, a childhood memory, just, you know, listening to you talk about that. I used to live at the beach in Southern California, and my sister got a hold of the recording, I think it was by Roger Payne, of the sounds of the humpback whale and played it on our stereo. And, you know, and I just remember staring out at the ocean, listening to those sounds, just mesmerized by thinking that, you know, those are creatures out there communicating with each other.
It is fascinating to think about whales communicating over really great distances using only sound.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I also saw that you are a MacArthur fellow, the so-called Genius Grant. And I've talked to a few people now that have won those. And it's always interesting to ask them, like, when did you find out that you had won that?
Well, they like to tell you without you having any warning. So I got a phone call early one weekday morning, which said, are you Kelly Benoit Bird? And if so, are you alone? Which is never a great way to start a conversation while you're still in your pajamas. Of course, we've all seen too many movies where that doesn't end well. But the person introduced themselves and said, I'm calling from the MacArthur Foundation. Have you heard of the MacArthur Fellowship? And did you know you were getting it before today? I hope not. It's supposed to be a secret. So everything's a little bit cloak and dagger, and you have several weeks where you know, but no one else is allowed to. And it's a really kind of a strange, surreal experience.
Yeah, you're not supposed to tell anyone. I mean, can you even tell like your significant other or your mom or dad or anybody? You can't tell anybody, can you?
They're okay with you telling your significant other, but I think the they like to keep it small because they do like to announce them all at once and have a lot of information available for people and the new fellows.
Yeah, that's exciting. And I'm sure that was a positive and life-changing thing for you. And from what I have observed of your work, it's definitely was money well spent.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's talk about the science of sound in the ocean. So I want you to kind of give us a primer on how do scientists like you use sound in order to study the ocean? Because like so much of what we, you know, see of the ocean is just the surface of it. And to understand what's going on underneath, you know, you can't really see that much. You can take ships out and put down hydrophones and things like that. But tell us about how you use sound to study the ocean.
Well, so I use sound to try to see life beneath the surface of the waves. As you just said, light doesn't penetrate very far in the ocean. Even if we bring artificial light down, we're lucky to be able to see 10 or 20 feet in front of us. And yet sound allows us to penetrate hundreds of meters deep into the ocean and look at where animals are and what they are and what they're doing, how they're interacting with each other to try to understand life in the deep. We do that using echo sounders. They're sonars that transmit very short pulses of sound, and then we interpret the echoes that come back from those. You might have used an echo sounder on a boat to try to see where the bottom is. We use systems very much like that, but that are much more sensitive and allow us to be able to look for life and not just the seafloor.
And you're interested in a specific, you're interested in a lot of things, but one of the things that I found fascinating looking at some of the research you've done is tell us about the mesopelagic region of the ocean, because that's really an interesting part of the ocean, and how you're studying it there is really fascinating. And then I'd also like you to address what kinds of instruments you're using, because when I was at Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, I got to see some of those autonomous undersea vehicles. They look like big yellow torpedoes. So if you could tell us a bit about those and what you're doing with them.
So the mesopelagic is the region in the ocean beneath where there's enough sunlight for plants to grow, but where it's not completely dark. And so the animals that live in this zone often migrate to the surface at night to feed under the cover of darkness, but they return to these shadowy depths to try to hide from visually hunting predators. We know that the animals in this region make up a huge proportion of the biomass in the ocean. Some estimates have the fish in this zone representing more than half of all of the fish biomass in the entire world's oceans. And they're critically important for how energy moves between the surface and the deep sea. So we're using a lot of different tools to be able to get at this zone. It's pretty challenging. It's at least 600 feet below the surface. And we're including those underwater robots that you got a chance to see, those yellow torpedoes, including some small vehicles that can stay out for about a week to 10 days at a time and carry our echo sounders, collecting data as they undulate up and down through the water column, collecting information like the temperature, the salinity, and the amount of plant life, while we're also collecting information on how many animals there are, what kinds they are, and where they're located. We're using larger AUVs, sometimes up to 20 feet long, that can carry our sensors, but also video cameras, so that we can confirm the identity of the organisms we're interested in, how large they are, and how those animals are oriented with respect to each other in space.
When you do video of them down there, when you do that, do you have to turn on lights? And when you do that, does that disturb the animals at all?
In most cases, we do need to turn on lights, and our research with sound is helping us to see exactly how much of an impact that has on the animals and in turn on our measurements. So we're able to see out hundreds of meters in front of the vehicle and see what the animals were doing before we got close enough to them for them to see our lights. We're working on new technologies that let us use less light or different colors of light that might disturb the animals somewhat less and let us get a better view into how they're living life in the deep. Because these animals are so incredibly sensitive to even very low levels of light, since that's an important cue for finding food and mates, as well as their risk of being eaten.
And this layer that you've been studying, the sound scattering layer, as I've seen it called, can you explain to us why it's the sound scattering layer? What's going on there?
So these animals in the mesopelagic form aggregations or layers where they're trying to stay close to their neighbors. And these layers were discovered in World War II using military sonars because they scattered sound. These sonar operators at the sort of beginning of use of this technology actually thought that they were the seafloor. Can you imagine if you were trying to drive around in an uncharted area and suddenly saw the bottom dramatically decreasing in depth? So you turn the other direction and no matter which way you go, it seems to keep getting shallower. That's because these animals were migrating up to the surface. And that actually happened until biologists were able to confirm that instead of the bottom, these layers were indeed layers of life.
And how deep is this generally, this layer that they kind of hang out at before they come up to feed?
Well, the depth depends exactly on where you are and what the conditions are, but typically it's around 600 feet or so down to about 4,000 feet, depending on the habitat, at least during the daylight hours. And then at night, these animals can come right up to the surface in order to access their food.
And during the day, are they kind of hanging out down there to hide? Is that kind of what's going on?
Exactly. They're trying to stay in sort of that twilight zone where it's really hard for visual predators to see them at enough distance to be able to make their meal.
And give us a sense of, you know, what types of critters species we're talking about.
So we're talking about animals like krill and lanternfish, or you may have heard of them referred to as myctophids, their scientific name. Deep sea smelts are bathylagids, invertebrates, including a variety of species of shrimp and small squid, all make up this layer and are all sort of mixed together, undergoing these migrations that move them thousands of feet in just 20 or 30 minutes. So really remarkable swims. If you wanted to put that on a human scale, it'd be the equivalent of you running a 10K twice a day, once for your dinner and once before you went to bed.
Wow. And can you give us a sense of, this is a pretty large population of the fish and the sea life in the ocean, isn't it, in this layer?
It is. The most recent estimates for the global abundance of these animals is about 10 billion, with a B, tons of biological resources.
And typically we don't fish for them?
We don't typically fish for them. These animals are hard to access, they're expensive to process, and they aren't really palatable to humans. Although in the last couple of years, a number of countries have begun to seek fishing permits and develop ways to process these fish into supplements for fish oil, as well as for feed for farmed fish.
Well, when I hear that, that always concerns me because we tend to, anytime we find a resource, we tend to exploit it and overfish it. So how is your scientific research going to help hopefully inform that, the decisions made about that?
Well, I think it's incredible that we have an opportunity to do science before these animals are exploited, at least in U.S. waters, because as you pointed out, we've rarely had that opportunity. And we know free-for-alls and fishing don't tend to end well. So our research is really aimed at understanding how these animals interact and what role they play in the ecosystem. How much carbon are they transporting and under what conditions? How are they sequestering carbon dioxide to the deep sea? What other fish are they feeding, the ones we actually want to eat? So what would the repercussions be? In fact, we don't even understand some of the really basic characteristics of these animals. For example, how frequently do they reproduce? How often do they live? And those are critical questions if we're to address creating a sustainable fishery.
That was the sound of a white-sided dolphin recorded by Hydrophones in Monterey Bay. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our discussion of the science of sound in the ocean with Monterey Bay Aquarium senior scientist Kelly Benoit-Bird. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's continue our conversation with Kelly Benoit-Bird from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. Well, let's go back to this interesting layer, this mesopelagic layer, the scattering layer where all of these animals are. Because I find it fascinating. I was reading some of your research that when the animals they're being hunted, of course, by other species like salmon and things like that, dolphins. Do they hang out together with their own kind, or how does that work? Are they all mixed up?
Well, we used to just think that they were all mixed up and that all of the animals were trying to get to the same levels of light and oxygen and food. And so they just ended up piled up in a layer. But our recent work has shown that instead, these animals actively form schools, that they stay with animals that look a lot like them, the same species, the same size, which we know in surface waters is a way to protect yourself from being hunted. It makes it really hard for a predator to capture individual, and it makes it easier for the animals in that school to detect those predators when they come by. So these animals aren't just forming a layer by accident. They're forming schools that are then connected into these layers as a means of predator defense.
Another thing I found really interesting in your sonar data is, you know, I tend to think of, you know, sound wave data, but it's kind of, now that I think about it, you do ultrasounds to check out unborn babies and things like that. But you actually get really neat pictures of what's going on down there. I saw one where you could actually see two dolphins, I think it was, that were hunting some of these other animals.
I think for me, that's the most exciting part about how we can use sound is that we can see animals interacting with each other. And for example, in that case you mentioned where we could see the dolphins and where they were and what kinds of animals were around them available to be eaten. And it is very much like the pictures we create from an ultrasound to see an unborn baby or the health of an organ. We are also using ultrasound, but instead of just peering into a single body, we're looking through the water to resolve the animals within that mass of water. And the higher the frequency we use, the higher the pitch of the sound, the more detail we can get out of those pictures.
So give me a sense of that. What kind of frequencies are you using for your sonar? And, compare that to levels of human hearing.
So our sonars typically begin just where human hearing stops, right around 20 kilohertz. But we use frequencies all the way up into the megahertz to be able to see animals. Now, higher pitches of sound up in the megahertz don't transmit very far, but they give you more resolution. So we're constantly trying to balance what kinds of organisms we want to see and how far away we need to be able to see them, which is one of the reasons we want to take platforms like underwater robots deep into the ocean so that we can get more resolution by getting closer to things to look at them.
Yeah, that all kind of came together in my brain as you were explaining it. I was like, that's why you want these robots down there, because then you can get closer to them and get these higher resolution images. And that's why they're so valuable.
Exactly. I think the other big reason for us is that we can't be in the ocean all the time. And yet, really interesting things happen during storms and over very short time intervals where we can't be out from day to day. And the only way we can really get at some of those questions is by having a persistent presence, by being at sea all the time, which we can do with robots and moorings and cabled systems in ways we really can't do from a ship.
Can you give us a sense of what kind of instrumentation you've got going out there in Monterey Bay there at MBARI?
Well, I can say that right now my team has a cabled sensor that's sitting on the bottom, getting power and Ethernet back to shore, taking data once every 2 seconds continuously, now for about 6 months. But at the same time, we also have one of those underwater vehicles that's carrying both our acoustic systems as well as an imaging system to try to understand exactly what animals we're seeing with that cabled system and what those animals are doing. How are they behaving as we look at them as individuals and as a population simultaneously? So that's one of the things we're out there doing today.
And how often do you actually go out to sea? And like when you're out there, how long are you out for?
So in our group, most of our research is done on day trips on either a small vessel or a somewhat larger one. And we do that about once or twice a week during the seasons where the weather is as helpful and a little bit less often when it's a little more challenging to be on the water.
And can you give us a sense of what a day is like for you working on a ship? Because I'd kind of like to imagine what it would be like to have a job like that. And for maybe some little girls and boys out there thinking they'd like to do what you do, tell them what it's like to be out on a ship doing what you do.
Well, I like to tell people that most of the time we're at sea is incredibly boring. At least we hope it is, because things are working well and everything's going as planned. But every once in a while, it's punctuated by remarkable excitement as we discover something, see an animal we haven't seen before, where a question we've been asking suddenly becomes clear. Most of the time, though, that excitement happens back in the lab, when we're analyzing data, sitting in front of a computer screen and trying to pull the puzzle pieces together to be able to get a clearer picture of what's happening out there in the ocean. One of the challenges we have in working out on a boat is that it's a platform that's constantly moving. And so for many people, that's something that takes a lot of getting used to. I know it has been that way for me. And every time I go to sea, I manage to learn something new about how I interact with the ocean, as well as the animals that are living within it.
So you do okay? You don't get seasick when you go out on the research vessel?
It's not a question of if you get seasick, it's when you get seasick. Everybody has been seasick under at least some conditions on certain boats. And we often hear from people, oh, I've been to sea and I've never been seasick before, but there's always a first time. So you want to be prepared and make sure you have a plan for doing your work, even under the most difficult conditions.
I live near the Sacramento River, and every day I see wildlife biologists go out to the fish traps in the Sacramento River. And on nice sunny days like this, it looks like, oh, that would be cool being out on a boat, you know, collecting your data and your specimens. But then I see they're also out there in storms and at night and when it's, you know, really not that fun to be out on the water.
And at the same time, I think if you ask people here who go out to sea regularly, whether they're excited about it, even under the most adverse conditions, the answer will unfailingly be yes, because that opportunity for discovery and exploration is really just exciting. And it's what feeds us. That curiosity kind of drives why we do what we do.
Yes. And I think there's also that if you love the ocean, and obviously you do, that really gets in your blood. The sea gets in your blood, and to go out on the ocean is really, it's a special way to spend time in your life. And every time you go out on the ocean, it's different, isn't it?
And I think that's true every time we go out in nature. I think every time we're given a chance to observe the natural world, it touches us in some way, not just from an intellectual standpoint, but I think it gives us a lot of peace and fills us with a bunch of sensations that we don't get from very many other situations. And that's certainly true for me on the ocean.
Something I was thinking about when you're talking about the active sonar that you're using, you know, because you're sending sound waves out, those don't disturb like whales or dolphins, do they?
They certainly can, and that's something we're really cognizant of in our research. We know that sonars that are used by the Navy, which are quite different from the ones that we use, but that are used for hunting submarines, for example, have been shown to have really significant impacts on some deep diving species like beaked whales. So depending on the kinds of questions we're asking and the habitat we're in, we think very carefully about the kinds of sounds we're using in terms of their frequency. Are they audible by these animals? Many of the signals we use are not. They're too high in frequency even for dolphins to hear. And we think about how loud those sounds are that we're making, how long they are, and how frequently we're using them. So that's definitely something we need to consider as we're thinking about any type of sensing that we do in the ocean, is how we're impacting our measurements and the animals that live there.
Okay, you mentioned the Navy, and I saw you did some research about those whales you just mentioned, the beaked whales. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on down there off the coast of Southern California? Because I know the Navy, there's been a lot of controversy over the years about them using these just incredibly powerful sonar sounds when they're out there looking for submarines and things like that. Could you tell us a bit about how that affects these particular whales?
So there have been correlations between the use of Navy tactical mid-frequency sonars and adverse events with beaked whales, particularly strandings in some habitats. Off Southern California, the Navy has a training and testing range where they use those systems to practice and to learn and train people how to use them effectively. In that habitat, there have not been those lethal effects observed, but instead, animals that are frequently exposed to those sonars tend to leave the range. They go somewhere else while those activities are happening, but then return really quickly after these activities cease. And so we wanted to understand how those training operations could be impacting the population. Is it affecting how many offspring they have, how often they calve, the success of those calves? So not just how it affects the individual and their behavior, but if it's having an effect on the growth rate of the entire regional population. And so we used higher frequency sonars on an underwater robot to try to map the distribution of squid, the food for these beaked whales, in and around that Navy range to understand why they keep coming back when they're so frequently disturbed. And when they leave, what are they giving up? What are the costs that they're paying?
And what are the costs that they're paying? Because these particular whales, they aren't able to store much food as fat compared to some other types of whales, are they?
That's right. They're what we call income breeders, meaning that they need to collect resources continuously in order to be able to survive and have offspring. And what we found was that where beaked whales like to feed in one particular area of the range, there were more squid that were slightly larger, but more importantly, those squid were clustered. So they were found in discrete, small aggregations, which means that a beaked whale, which is diving a kilometer deep, half a mile deep, in order to get to their food, is able to get many squid on a single dive. They can only make 10 or 12 dives a day, and so it's critically important that they have access to multiple squid on each of those dives. But in the areas where they're not found as frequently, those squid tend to be sort of uniformly or randomly spread out, which makes it really hard to swim from one squid to the next and capture enough food. And so that's why they keep coming back. Those aggregations, that patchy squid, are critically important to them. And that just doesn't happen everywhere. We don't know why, but we let the beaked whales tell us what it was about their habitat that's important to their survival.
When we talk about animals that use sonar themselves, what are the principal creatures of the sea that really use sonar?
So the odontocete brain mammals, that is dolphins, and some things we call whales like beaked whales and killer whales, but are indeed, by their evolutionary history, dolphins as well. Those are the only animals that we know of that use biosonar in the ocean. The challenge for a beaked whale, though, is that they have to be able to see with very high resolution, but they also need to make decisions about where they're going to forage from more than a kilometer away, because that's how deep they need to dive. And so their sonar is great at detecting individual squid and tracking them. It's not so great at finding them from 1,000 meters away, from a kilometer away. And so they don't have a lot of information when they leave the surface about where food might be. So it's really important for them that they have some predictability in the habitat and to make those choices without a lot of information from their sonar.
So when they dive, they literally are hunting.
Exactly.
I'm interested in, like, for you personally, when you talk to people about what you do, what's the biggest, like, misconception that people have about your work? Like, a question you get asked where, you know they just quite don't quite understand what you do.
I think the biggest question I get asked that's just a little bit wrong is, what does the ocean sound like? Because while I'm interested in sounds animals make, mostly we're using sound in a way that's analogous to how animals do to be able to understand them. So we're using sonar in order to be able to understand life. Kind of a flip on the biosonar question, instead of just listening to the sounds the animals make. I think the other misconception people often have is that we spend all of our time on a boat and at sea, and they forget that a lot of what we do is working with information and trying to convert those numbers that we collect into something meaningful. So we spend a lot of time in an office looking at a computer trying to put these pieces together.
Give me a sense of what that ratio is. So like for a day out to sea, you said you go out for a day at a time. How many days in the lab are you crunching numbers and doing that kind of work?
The answer to that depends a lot on the question and how new it is, but it's pretty typically 2 to 4 times as much time in the lab as on the water.
Well, that's pretty typical, I think, of any kind of scientific field work. You go out in the field, you collect your data, and then you got to go back and figure out, what does it all mean?
Exactly. And that's where the real discoveries happen, as we're piecing together these disparate pieces of information from different sensors and different platforms and trying to put together that bigger picture.
Do you have any favorite ocean sounds, like, you know, that you would put on your mix list?
Well, I think the sounds of the humpback whale are sort of the most striking. The complex, repetitive songs are sort of eerily beautiful, and they always make me think of the ocean. There's something about the sound that captures life. Most of the sounds I'm most excited by, though, I only get to see on a computer screen because they're too high in frequency for us to hear. I think the variety and utility of the biosonar signals that dolphins make is really astounding. And I'm always inspired by that as we develop new types of sonar and are inspired by the solutions that evolution has come up with in both the signal design and signal processing. But unfortunately, those aren't signals we can hear.
Well, and when you mentioned the humpback whales, it reminded me of that old, it's an old movie now, Star Trek IV, which kind of, you know, they shoot it at Monterey Bay Aquarium. I know Mbari is at a different location, but it's, you know, you're under the same umbrella. And there's the famous line in there where they quote D.H. Lawrence. They say the sea is cold, but the sea contains the hottest blood of all.
And what a wonderful thought to end our conversation with today.
Yeah. Well, good luck with you and the rest of your work. And congratulations on the MacArthur Fellowship. That's wonderful. And it was really fun to talk to you and just learn more about how you're using sound to study the ocean.
Well, thank you so much to you and to your listeners for joining us for this conversation.
And now let's hear the most iconic ocean sounds of all, the songs of the humpback whale, as recorded by Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute hydrophones. We're going to take a short break. I'm Dave Shlom, and this is Blue Dot. When we come back, we'll talk to John Ryan, a researcher at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, who records the sounds that travel through the ocean, from earthquakes and passing ships to whale songs. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute research scientist John Ryan. Ryan joined us from Mbari in Moss Landing, right at the head of the Monterey Bay Submarine Canyon, to talk about recording and analyzing sounds that travel through seawater. How are you doing, John?
Doing well, Dave. Thanks, and you?
I'm great, and it's really exciting to talk to you because I'm fascinated by this subject of sounds in the ocean. Before we get into some of your latest research, I'd like to know a little bit about you. How did you get interested in ocean acoustics and recording sounds in the ocean?
For most of my career, I've studied microscopic life, and sound was the first opportunity to study the largest life forms in the sea. And I got interested in it because we have, here at Mbari, we have a cabled observatory, which is a connection to the deep sea through which power and communications are pretty much unlimited. So this cable observatory sits just outside Monterey Bay in deep water, and it has 8 science ports, so plenty of room to plug in different instruments and experiments. So talking with a friend, actually, I got the idea that we could begin studying ocean life here at Mbari off Central California by recording and analyzing sound.
Yes, because and this is interesting to me because we're talking about Mars here, right? Not the red planet, but the Monterey Accelerated Research System, which is this observatory that you have cabled out there, and it's like, 3,000 feet deep? It's in the deep ocean, isn't it?
Yes, not the deepest, but it's on the continental slope in 900 meters nearly 3,000 feet of water. And, we had reason to believe that that would be a good place to listen because it's relatively quiet, and yet it's in an area where marine mammals are living.
One of the things I found interesting about this is in the past, when you're trying to do these kinds of recordings, you're kind of limited by, battery power and, how much space you have on whatever your recording device is. But you don't have that problem with this cabled observatory, do you?
We don't. And that's important in a number of ways. The first is that if we want to understand ocean life, we have to record and analyze sound that is not only within our range of hearing, but also well outside of it. So, for example, some dolphins are producing echolocation clicks that are more than 5 times above the upper frequency limit that we can hear. But so if we want to study these dolphins that are putting out very high frequency sounds, we have to sample sound at a very high rate. So we're sampling sound at over 250,000 times per second. And that's, that allows us to study most biological sounds by covering that full range. And the thing is that recording at such a high sample rate produces a massive amount of data. So if you are recording standalone on a package that's not streaming data to shore as we are, then you're strongly limited by data storage. Or you may be limited by how long your battery will last. But here we're supplying power and we're receiving back data. It's like a giant auditory nerve, 52 kilometers long, extending from Moss Landing, where our building is, out into the deep sea. And it's really unlimited.
And when did this start? When did you start recording? When did you first place the instrument out there?
A few days ago, we passed the 4-year mark. And, 4 years seems like a long time, but if you want to study variation at different timescales, one of those really important timescales is so-called interannual. How do things change from year to year? And you can't do that with really even 2 years of data. With 2 years, you could just say, they were different. You get into 3 and 4 years, you can begin to see whether or not there are substantial trends in what you're hearing. So for example, in studying humpback whale song, once we got up to 3 years of recording, we could see a very strong interannual trend. Over that 3-year period, the amount of time during which we were hearing humpback whale song more than doubled. And so, yes, 4 years is starting to get us into very interesting research territory.
And when you're studying this, you're not just listening, you know, to these recordings, as fascinating as they are to listen to, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but you analyze them because they are a spectrogram. I mean, like when I record my own voice, I can see the spectrogram of it on my recording device. So you're able to use, I imagine, pretty sophisticated software to analyze what you're recording, right?
That's right. We absolutely need fairly sophisticated software, and we need time to develop that software so that it's effective. The amount of data we produce from that single hydrophone, well, it's a lot. It's little hydrophone, big data. By that, I mean 2 terabytes per month from a single instrument. And we can produce spectrograms that span the full frequency range of the sounds we're recording, and we do on a routine basis. And we can scan those visually, but when it comes time to create reliable scientific results, a human manually analyzing this data can only do so much in a day. And it's really impossible to study all the sound sources we want to understand with manual analysis. So we need these more sophisticated methods, their development and their implementation in a so-called workflow, so that routinely we can pipe the data through this analysis pipeline and get detection and classification results for a variety of sound sources. And those sound sources are in one of three categories. The first, so-called biophony, is the sounds of marine life. We're very interested in that because that has implications for understanding nature and our management environments, in this case, a national marine sanctuary, and protection of species. The second category of sound sources are human activities. We're interested in that because we're just beginning to realize how much our noise can impact marine life in ways that are not beneficial. And the third category is geophony, sounds of the earth. So we hear earthquakes, submarine landslides, rain, wind. So it gives us a really complete description of the ocean in a unique way.
Wow, that's interesting. And could you give us an example of something using the software analysis where you figured out, like, aha, this is what's going on, one of those aha moments?
So, okay, an aha moment. Well, understanding how animals that live underwater are, you know, rarely at the surface, understanding how they use sound, it's quite a challenge. And so really anything we learn about how they're using sound can be an aha moment. But I'll start with an example from blue whales, the largest animal species ever to have lived on Earth, and fairly abundant in the Northeast Pacific. They are an endangered species, so understanding their lives and how we can better protect them is really important to us. So they make 4 different types of vocalizations in this region, and we're studying all of these different types of sounds that they make and how they use them. We're trying to understand how and when they use these calls. So right away, the continuous recording from the Mars Observatory gives us the ability to study the detection of these vocalizations, the patterns that show up from year to year, month to month, day versus night. And that alone is an aha moment, you know, just learning how they use different calls during different periods of the day, for example, or during different times of the year. But what's really fascinating about this study of blue whales is we're working with a lab at Stanford, Jeremy Goldbogen's lab. And his student, Will Aestreich, is doing his thesis work on blue whales. And half of it is studying these years of recordings that we've made. The other half is to observe the life of a blue whale from the perspective of a blue whale. And they do that by putting tags that attach to the blue whale's body with a big suction cup. And on the tag, there are a variety of instruments that allow them to see the ocean world from the perspective of the whale. That includes video, acoustic recording, accelerometers, measurements of the environment. And right away, we're beginning to now be able to see when an animal makes a certain type of call, what's happening in their environment. Where are they? Are they deep? Are they shallow? What have they been doing recently? And so in this way, the years of recordings from the Mars hydrophone can be put in the context of this species' life activities. So already we're seeing that two of the call types very commonly occur together, and they co-vary throughout the year. They have the same seasonal cycle, whereas a third type of call is being used much earlier in the year, more during the summer, whereas the other calls are happening during the fall. And so again, combined with viewing the world from their perspective, we can see how they're using sound in their daily life activities and as their life activities change with the seasons.
It's interesting to think about tagging a blue whale, the largest animal on Earth. That must be a kind of an adventure all in itself.
It is an adventure. I have not done it yet. The lab we're collaborating with does this all the time. Blue whales, fin whales, humpback whales. And of course, that involves its own technology development. How can you measure more about the animal and its environment on a compact, lightweight tag? And yes, they have to approach the animal very carefully. They have this suction cup tag on the end of a long pole. And, you know, just by placing it on the back, it will, you know, it's just a suction cup, so it will only stay on for hours to days. But during that short time, the data that's recorded can reveal a lot about the lives of the blue whales.
Well, let's talk about some of the greatest hits from the hydrophone out there. What are some of the ones that, you know, you've shared online that are the most interesting to you that people comment a lot about?
Well, I find all of the recordings, especially of the marine mammals, to be outstanding, wonderful, fascinating, delightful. So it's hard to pick one. But I will say that I love the low-frequency vocalizations of the largest whales, the baleen whales. Why? Because you don't just hear the sound with through your ears and the vibration of your eardrums and your the inner workings of your auditory system. You feel it throughout your body. Your whole body shakes, or the walls around you shake. So it gives you a sense of the power and the size of this animal. I think that these very low frequency sounds, because they can reach right into the whole body, they give you a kind of a more complete and full experience or sense of the nature of that animal. So they're in my top 10. That would include blue whales and fin whales. They're putting out frequencies at and below the limit of our hearing. Humpback whales, they're always delightful, and they're as delightful to listen to as to look at in a spectrogram, because you look at a, you know, 15 to 30 minute song composed by a humpback whale, and it looks like a sheet of music. It covers a large frequency range. It has an elegance in the way they may begin a song in the high frequency range, then fill out the mid frequencies and end toward the lower frequencies. And then they'll repeat that song almost exactly, or they may improvise from song to song. And it's beautiful visually as well as you listen to it.
When you talked about the experiencing those sounds, feeling in your body, you can't really experience that without a really large set of speakers with big subwoofers. How can you go about that?
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Either a good set of headphones or a subwoofer will allow you to get a sense of the very low frequency vocalizations. However, a subwoofer is much better because it moves the air in the room. So that's a more, and it also vibrates, you know, your chest or all the tissues in your body for that matter. It can make the walls kind of shake. And so the subwoofer is the best experience. And I acquired a subwoofer for our education and outreach. I got it used. And it has a frequency response down to 15 hertz, which is below the limit of our hearing, and that is very effective. I lug that giant subwoofer around in my subcompact car often so that I can bring a more complete experience to people, give them a chance to really connect with the nature of that sound. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. Technology is needed to get this experience across. And yet, still, there's something missing, right? We're listening to these sounds in air. And air is much less dense than water, whereas the whales, of course, are putting this sound into water. Now, there's a few important things about that. The first is that sound travels incredibly well in water, more than four times faster in water than in air. And it can travel tremendous distances. Light can reach, at most, hundreds of meters into the ocean from the surface, sunlight, whereas sound can travel thousands of kilometers. And so sound is such a powerful carrier of information and energy in the ocean. So that's if we really want to experience what that's like from the perspective of a marine mammal, receiving that sound while we're in water, I think would be much more complete and much more authentic.
Cool. Well, thanks, John. I really appreciate you sharing your expertise in the world of sound under the waves, because it really is fascinating.
Thank you for your interest, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute scientists Kelly Benoit Bird and John Ryan, and a special thank you to Kim Fulton Bennett, the public information specialist who took me on a fascinating tour of the Institute in Moss Landing, California. I even got to stand on the bridge of the research vessel, the Rachel Carson, and there'll be a picture of that on our website, mynspr.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.